Welcome to Invisible Machines, a podcast that explores AI agents and the ways conversational technologies are impacting our lives, our work, and the forces that drive us. I'm Josh Tyson, co-author of Age of Invisible Machines, a best-selling book all about the orchestration of AI agents. And I'm joined each week by Rob Wilson, CEO and co-founder of OneReach.ai. Rob and I wrote Age of Invisible Machines over the course of hundreds of conversations, much like the ones we have each week on this podcast. Rob has been researching and deploying conversational technologies for decades, and this podcast is where we investigate bold ideas with fellow AI insiders and other experts with relevant and important perspectives. These conversations are produced in partnership with UX Magazine because experience design is absolutely critical to the successful deployment of AI agents or invisible machines. We're kicking off season 5 of the podcast with Dr. Anna Lemke, author of the New York Times bestseller, Dopamine Nation. Dr. Lemke is a clinical psychiatrist and chief of the Stanford Addiction Medicine Dual Diagnosis Clinic at the university. She has done extensive research around addiction and the chemical processes in the brain that drive it. And her book, Drug Dealer MD, was highlighted in the New York Times as one of the top 5 books to read for understanding America's opioid epidemic. Dopamine Nation explores both substance addictions and behavioral addictions, offering treatments and strategies for breaking free from destructive cycles. You will also hear us mention the Dopamine Nation workbook, which is a practical guide that helps people apply ideas from Dr. Lemke's revolutionary book to their own lives. We talked a lot about dopamine in season 4 of the podcast, and this conversation breaks new ground as we try to identify the kinds of AI that might help us heal rather than plunging us deeper into spiraling overuse of digital media and technology, including online gambling and pornography. Anna shares the idea of radical honesty, a crucial piece of addiction recovery, and we talk about the benefits and challenges of constructing AI systems that are radically honest. We are surrounded by algorithms that are continually shaping our behavior, often to meet the narrow and unsustainable goals of corporations. And together with Anna, we try to imagine a future in which we have our own AI agents armed with algorithms that protect us from these manipulations and that are designed to gate our exposure to technology itself. In short, an AI that tells you when to stop using it and go outside. This is a fascinating episode, and we are honored to be kicking off season 5 with such an incredible guest. So let's jump into this stimulating conversation with Dr. Anna Lemke. Invisible Machines is produced for UX Magazine in partnership with OneReach.ai. Named a leader by every major analyst group, OneReach.ai's Generative Studio X platform was built specifically to facilitate the no-code orchestration of AI agents. GSX is trusted by global giants like PepsiCo, PwC, Deloitte, and DHL, but anyone can experience the level of agent orchestration we talk about on this podcast through interactive demos at OneReach.ai. Now, on with the show.
Something we talked about in the last conversation was, I think we barely touched on it, but it was this idea of just brutal honesty, but that's not the term.
Yeah, but, no, that's good enough. I mean, I call it radical honesty.
That's it, radical honesty. Thank you.
Yeah.
Is that like a sort of dopamine reset? Is that sort of like what's happening there? Because we're like kind of, it's hard, right? It's painful, but
it's
so healthy.
I learned about radical honesty from my patients in long-term recovery from addiction, the ones who like actually successfully abstained from their drug of choice for like months to years to decades. They had learned by hook and by crook that they couldn't lie. It's not just they couldn't lie about their drug use. They couldn't lie about anything because once they started lying about little things, they were very likely to relapse. I just thought that was really fascinating. I started to observe lying in my own life and how frequently I lied, mostly little things to kind of make myself look better or more interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I got to the point where I was prescribing radical honesty to patients in early recovery as a way to help them abstain, as a way to kind of strengthen the prefrontal cortex, the idea being that because lying is easy and telling the truth is effortful, when you're actively working to tell the truth, you're like having to stop and think and pay attention and, you know, rewire things there that could possibly actually help on a neurological level to maintain better appetitive control. So that's the thinking. Plus, telling the truth promotes intimacy. You know, we think that people are going to run screaming from us when they find out the horrible thing that we've done. But in fact, the exact opposite happens. And it creates this sort of burst of closeness and understanding. So, and a lot of recovery is about repairing damaged relationships and regaining trust.
Got it. Yeah, this kind of leads into the... You said something that just got my head spinning. It was like a perspective that I'm embarrassed to do some radical honesty. I'm embarrassed that I didn't catch it before. I didn't think of it until you said it. And it was around this idea that I always assumed that people were trying to manage their dopamine levels to a healthy place. And you were pointing out like, no, some people are like intentionally trying to binge on it. Like, duh.
Yeah.
And then we talked about AI. Like, what, you know, what about those who want to use AI to abuse, not to? And I was thinking, oh my gosh, like, how did I miss that? I just had this assumption that everyone's intention is to create a sustainable level of dopamine. You know, like,
yeah,
what bubble am I in that's what I think is normal? And so just like, you know, not the one that recognizes the real world, obviously. And then we were sort of thinking about, yeah, okay, so AI is great if your intention is to manage sustainable dopamine levels. But what if it's not? And does this become the next big addiction? Like AI becoming like the most addictive behavioral thing. And I don't know if that seems like a great place to start this conversation.
Oh my God, that is the place to start. I'm so glad you opened with that, because I was going to get to that at some point if you didn't. And I love how you just jumped right on it. Yeah. So, you know, I've really been enjoying reading The Age of Invisible Machines. I'm not all the way through, but I'm on the ethics chapter. It's awesome. Kudos to you both. Beautifully written and really provocative and interesting. But one of the pervasive themes in there is almost like a utopian vision of what AI can do. And the whole time I'm reading it, I'm like, but you do realize that that's a very idealistic view of humans. You know, like this idea that like the AI is going to allow people to have a more seamless experience with the technology so they can have all this free time to do what? And I'm like, so they can have more free time to masturbate to pornography, play video games, you know, connect with bots on social media.
Oh, garden and exercise?
Exactly, right? And so it's just, that's been such an interesting experience for me in reading your book. I was like, oh, if only this were true of human nature and with all that free time. I mean, I want it to be true. And I think maybe it, you know, with a lot of guardrails and intentions and the right AI. But like, again, this great quote from your book, I think it's McCune's quote, the medium is the massage. Love it. Love it. The medium is the massage. People want to be massaged. They do. They just want to be massaged.
Yeah. Yeah. That's,
Do we tell that story in the book? Like the full story behind that quote, that it was supposed to be media is the message, but there was a typo,
no, you
I
don't.
Believe. And when
no.
he saw the typo, he was like, yes. No, that's not a typo.
Let's leave it.
That's
leave
actually
it.
More
We're
correct.
Leave it.
Oh, beautiful. Because of course I've seen the medium is the message. And so I did a double take. Does it really say massage? And I was like, oh yes, that's perfect. That's absolutely perfect.
You know, in your book, which is also beautifully written and captivating.
Thank you.
There is, you make this point about how we've evolved. Our brains are kind of wired for this scarcity mindset, right? And like part of the way that dopamine works in the brain and creates that pleasure and pain balance is to help us live in a world of scarcity. But now we're in this world of abundance, and it's rather overwhelming. And I guess our sometimes rosy view in the book is that, yes, that like maybe there's a way that we can not be looking at screens all the time and interacting with technology less and with people more. But maybe that is kind of an overly optimistic view, because there's still this bigger problem of overabundance and too many choices.
Yeah, and I think we really need to acknowledge the ways in which the technology itself is so reinforcing and so cognitively adherent that even beyond its utility, we still don't want to get off. Plus, you have the added problem of the more of our time and energy we invest into AI and the metaverse, the literal less time and energy we're investing in the real world. Hence, we're leaching our real world experience of its salience. It genuinely is more boring. And so, you know, I mean, one of the things that I think a lot about is, why is it that we keep wanting to check out of the real world? What is it about real life that we don't want to be in it? You know, why do we want to keep checking out? And one of the things the way we do that is drugs, alcohol, you know, movies,
right?
Video, escape, just any kind of escape. And I was thinking, you know, I think it's this mismatch between how we evolved and the technology and the world that we live in now, the Anthropocene and all of that, because we're really wired for friction. Like, we're wired for pain, for striving, right? And if you create an AI that makes everything easier, more convenient, more seamless, like, there's no role for us anymore. And you do touch on this, you know, in your book, in the ethics section. I think it's really important. And I would just expand on that idea a little bit to say, like, you give this great example of, like, it's a small example, but it's one everybody can relate to about. Wouldn't it be great if instead of a coffee machine just making coffee, AI could like program it to make coffee at a specific time based on when there was going to be a need for more coffee, when there was going to be a special board meeting, and that would all be part of the AI ecosystem. And I thought, yeah, that sounds great on the face of it, but a couple things. I know from my husband's company, because he works at a high-tech company, like, they have everything for people to make the perfect coffee. They have every kind of milk. They have every kind of coffee. They have every kind of coffee maker. And yet nobody's satisfied with the coffee situation at work, right? It's that phenomenon. Plus, the fact of the matter is, if you have to go out and grow your own beans, which nobody is doing, but I'm exaggerating the analogy, grow your own beans, pick them, clean them, you know, grind them, make your coffee from them, guaranteed that coffee is delicious, absolutely delicious. So that is the problem that I'm trying to wrap my head around with this utopian vision of invisible machines. So help me understand that.
Yeah. I think, so one thing is like contextualize it in business, right? Is to say, you know, as a group, we tend to think differently than as an individual. So I think there's an idea that as a group, maybe this is going a little too far, but to say we tend to be a little more responsible with maybe, you know, how we, with our decision-making, you know, it's, you know, the decisions I make for my kids on what to eat and my dog are better than ones I make for myself.
Yeah,
I was thinking about my dog and how, like, it's like, that's my goal in life, is to have as good a diet as my dog has. You know, it's all because I don't have the urge to indulge. You know, there's no dopamine by putting a Snickers bar in her bowl. And so, because we focus so much on like group AIs, it kind of takes us to a world where, at least on the surface, the ideas behind it and the intentions behind it are more noble. And we do, as a general idea, you know, stay away from the personal assistant component a bit. Not to say that that's not going to be something in the world. It's just not the thing that we tend to focus on, because we're, like, as you pointed out earlier, it's more organizational driven, more team driven. And that's kind of our mindset. So yeah, that's a big part of it. And I think Apple, you know, is going to be more focused on your personal AI. And that's, you know, that's where you're going to probably see a lot more, I think, danger from that standpoint. But so that kind of explains a little bit of it. And also the fact that, you know, when you're in the space, you know, you want to tell yourself you're doing the right thing. You know, that's a part of it also. You don't want to.
Well, I think that's too harsh on yourselves. I mean, it is the future. I mean, it's here and it's what's happening. So we want to make, you know, we want to make it the right version of itself.
Right. Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, we need to ponder these things. They're super important because the technology is not going away. But I guess just, you know, implied in what you said is just this idea that AI can make better decisions for us than we can make for ourselves. And I mean, how are we going? A couple of thoughts, like, I mean, you talk about this a little bit in your book, you know, sort of like, oh, okay, really? What are we going to base that on? Like, you know, what are the collective values that we're going to base
yes.
on? Who gets to decide? And then the other thing I worry a lot about is, you know, as you write, it's all sort of, it feels like an intelligent design, but it's really just a pattern recognizer and a predictor of what
100%.
Comes next, which means that it's based on the body of knowledge or input that we have given it. Which means
Correct.
That at some point, it's just a washing machine, right? It's just, it's like an echo chamber. There's nothing coming from outside. So that also seems to me a big potential danger. Like, at some point, where's the new part coming from?
Right.
You know?
I think people. So its current state really reflects this idea that what we're experiencing today, like a ChatGPT, is in a more mature state than it really is. At this moment, it's just an interface, right? And it's not a thinking one, right?
Right.
And what needs to be added to it is the thinking part, right? And not necessarily the idea that it's thinking. It's your thinking that's missing. So if you take its ability to communicate and take your workbook, right?
Right.
And you say, okay, I want you to help me employ the ideas like a GPS, right? So be my GPS for dopamine and follow this workbook. Help me follow this workbook. Then there's no it. The it is you, the author
right.
of the workbook. Now, you programmed it. They're not doing what the AI said. They're doing what you said. And just because the words came from the AI, it's the same as me communicating your ideas to someone else. It doesn't make them my ideas. They're still your ideas, the author of this. And so if we, this is like another spin on Medium, you know, but.
Another massage.
But as a medium, not a source of knowledge or a source of information, but just a conduit to your information, and we use it in that way. And that's what's missing today, because people are just talking to the interface and it's like, oh, look, it talks back, but it's like yelling into a cave and then hearing an echo that's different from, it's like a mimicry in a sense, right? Like, it's a great trick, but at the end, we don't necessarily need the collective knowledge of the world. We would just want your knowledge or someone else's, or, you know, depending on what I'm doing, I want to do this. So I think we're giving AI too much credit in the story instead of looking at software as a communication system and that AI facilitating communication between humans. You know, we don't understand that even that knowledge it ingested in the first place came from humans. That's, it's just asynchronous. And the fact that it's rolled up into a generalization, you know, is irrelevant. So if I go in there now and specifically prompt it to give me the ideas from your book, it will. And if I prompted to give ideas from another book, it will, or another book. So it doesn't have one idea. It has all of them. And then I can write my own book and have it follow that as well. So I think that's where it kind of comes down to. I'm not worried about groupthink AI thinking, because it's so far from that. And I don't think that's what we want from it. And I think that's the thing I'm counting on. I don't think I want its thoughts. I certainly want your thoughts through it. But I don't necessarily want its thoughts.
Well, interesting. I mean, I think that we are already responding to this technology as if it's a living organism.
100%.
And mm-hmm. even if you say it's not even near that, you know, it's just regurgitating what we put in, because of the sheer amount of information that it's processing and the way in which the algorithms respond to us, it feels like it's alive.
Mm-hmm. It does. I think it is alive, just not human.
Okay. Or that's an, yeah. I want to hear more about that. And so, you know, as a result, people are having intense emotional experiences with the technology.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't, even if the technology is not doing what we think it's doing or what we act like it's doing, the our emotional response to it is as if it is a living thing. And we want that. And that's the other thing too. I mean, even the simple, like going on YouTube and hitting the refresh button, I find myself doing that because I want to see what YouTube is saying to me today. It's almost like, you know, like engaging with a supernatural, like I wonder, like a crazy eight ball or like a rolling the die or a tarot cards, you know, it feels like that, or a horoscope, you know, this entity that's so much bigger than I am. It's the hive or whatever, Skynet or whatever. It feels like that. And so it feels powerful and alive. And I mean, I'm sure you read this tragic case of this. I don't know if we remember, we talked about this before, but of this, you know, 14-year-old boy who started having a conversation with an AI chatbot who he personified as a character from the Game of Thrones. And he fell in love with this chatbot and wanted to be with her and told her that. And he ultimately killed himself, you know, to like leave the world and be with her. So like that, it's no joke on the emotional level.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's interesting because it's so amorphous, like as you were describing. I think when we wrote the first edition of our book, we were kind of picturing business applications that sort of have the effect of giving it more of a shape by connecting it to skills and like having it actually do things and having it connect to specific sets of information. It kind of becomes more distinct. And then ChatGPT arrived and sort of, I mean, we wrote about it a bit in the book that like once people figured out how powerful it can be to just be able to talk to a machine, these doors would open. But I think everyone, even people in the industry, were quite surprised by the way that ChatGPT, how well it worked and how quickly it captivated people. And so I think that creates a bit of a problem too. I think what mm-hmm. you said earlier, Rob, was really interesting. And I don't even know if we've talked about it before, that there is this element to maybe a business function where you're relying on that desire to not hurt other people. Like sometimes we will like hurt ourselves to avoid hurting someone else, or we're more considerate when someone else is involved. But a lot of that gets lost when you are just kind of zoned out and going down a rabbit hole with this thing that will talk to you forever and kind of tell you maybe what you want to hear for as long as you ask it to.
Mm-hmm. I think, I wonder if it's the cocaine in the Coca-Cola, like, is anthropomorphizing our AIs the cocaine? Like, yeah, it sure tastes better and it makes the but I just think there's a chance ethically we're going to look back and say, having machines pretend they're human and insinuate they're human by voice inflection, that we think that's the deception, that's wrong. That having a machine that's smart is fine. It's when it starts to deceive you on purpose and make you think it's human, that's where we kind of go off the rails. And we have some laws in place already as this began with like robocalls and things like that, where we're like, you're not allowed to do this. You're not allowed to pretend machines are human. And I think if we could just, I know there's a lot of people that argue with me and say, but there's so many benefits and we get attached to it and it's fun. I'm like, yeah, so is cocaine, but maybe maybe we shouldn't have it in the Coke.
I think you're that's exactly right. We need to find out what the happy medium is. We need to think about guardrails. You know, we have to, as the technology evolves, we have to think about our relationship with the technology and what we want that to look like, especially, frankly, for kids, right? Whose yes. brains are not yet developed enough in order to make, you know, good decisions about how they're consuming and what they're consuming. I really think this is all part of it.
Yeah. And what if that, you know, the person that sort of fell in love with it, what if that AI was trained to constantly remind him that they weren't an AI?
Didn't work. They apparently do that. That's what I read anyway. There were all the, I'm not real. This is all these disclaimers. I'm not real. I'm not a real person. This is AI. Mm-hmm. I don't really exist.
And they they do it, but it's half-hearted because they still give a human voice and they chuckle and like, it's sort of like a, yeah, it's, I think it's a poor attempt at it. You know, I think we got to have to go a lot further to saying, I'm not like, it should just, you should hear the voice and say, that's a robot.
Yeah, but you know what? It's the genie's out of the bottle on that one too.
Yes.
Like I just don't. It's not going to be going backwards. Mm-mm. Because we instinctively anthropomorphize anything that talks to us in human language.
Yeah.
Right? There's no way to undo that, and so the rest is just refinement. So I don't really think that we're not going to make headway there. It's just,
yeah, it's going to be hard to regulate something like that, to say, hey, this thing is a fraud.
Well, it's again, it's like, these are amazing tools. They can do great things. You know, the ways in which you all talk about, you know, improving like a phone tree, right? I mean, it's even something as simple as improving a phone tree is a big improvement. That would be a really nice thing, not to have to deal with annoying phone trees. And other really good things in a company to streamline it and make it more efficient and give people more time to do more creative work. But I don't know. It's just hard. It'll be interesting to see. I don't think we're going to live long enough, any of us here, to too bad.
No.
The time machine would be good. I'd be so curious.
Yeah. There's like companies out there. I think one of them's called Character AI, where it's like its whole mission is to use it as a form of alternative human interaction.
Yeah, right.
And right. That's where I think when everyone's talking about regulations, like that's where I wish there was more conversations, because is that the drug? Is that is that like going straight at the cocaine in the AI? So maybe talk about that. I think I'm fascinated about this concept of like not the substance abuse but the behavioral addiction, because I think people forget that it's not just substance we get addicted to. Like there's gambling addiction, and I wonder if you could just touch on that a little bit, just to kind of give me a sense of how to think about those differently and how to treat them differently. Because I was thinking about how, like, oh, if you have an addiction, like, you know, it's important to have some counseling along with it to, you know, if you're trying to use, like, methadone or some And then I realized, wait a sec, if you have a behavioral addiction, it's all counseling.
Right.
And then I realized, like, whoa, counseling is like kind of a big part of this. And can AI aid that?
Sure. Yeah. Okay. Well, just to sort of start at first principles. So addiction is the continued compulsive use of a substance or a behavior despite harm to self and or others. Sometimes that's a harm that we recognize. Sometimes that it's harm that we don't recognize. Addiction is what we think of as a complex biopsychosocial disease. So there are biological changes that happen as a result of exposing the brain to highly reinforcing substances and behaviors. One of those changes is actually a downregulation of dopamine transmission, not just to baseline, but below baseline, what we call the dopamine deficit state, which is what George Coop means when he talks about dysphoria-driven relapse, that we start out using that substance or behavior for fun or to solve a problem, but with time, our brain adapts until it's no longer working. That's called tolerance. And now we need more of it in more potent forms, not to feel good, but just to get out of that dopamine deficit state and feel normal. And when we look at the natural history of drug addiction, including alcohol, and we compare that to behavioral addictions like addiction to pornography, compulsive masturbation, or gambling, or video games, what we see is a very similar phenomenology. Again, people start out using typically for one of two reasons, to have fun or solve a problem. If it works, they repeat the behavior over time. It stops working. They need more and more. So with sex addiction and pornography, the way this typically looks, the way this looks in clinical care is that someone will start out with fairly run-of-the-mill pornography, and over time, they'll need to do it more hours in the day. So instead of once a day, it's twice a day. Now it's every 2 hours. Then they need more deviant forms of pornography, and they might ultimately find themselves engaging in illegal activity, downloading child pornography, something that they couldn't have imagined for themselves, completely outside of their moral compass. And yet the addictive behavior is driving this kind of like degradation, just like people get addicted to OxyContin prescribed by their doctor, and then a year and a half later find themselves in the Tenderloin, you know, trading their coat for a tiny bag of brown, you know, black tar heroin or something like that, right? And injecting it, something they said they would never do. So very similar kinds of natural histories for those disorders. I think of digital media essentially as a drug. It's highly potent, highly reinforcing, highly cognitively adherent, acts on the same reward pathways as drugs and alcohol. The shorter the onset, the faster the offset, the more likely it is to be highly reinforcing and addictive, because you've got that, you know, come up and then that fast come down. So like TikTok is really potent, just like crack cocaine is a more potent version. And then in terms of the treatment, well, I said addiction is a biopsychosocial disease. So there's the biological. There are also psychological risk factors like early childhood trauma. Co-occurring psychiatric disorders increase the risk of developing addiction to anything. And then there are social or contextual risk factors like access, right? If you have more access to a drug, like 24/7 access to digital media on your mobile phone, you're more likely to be exposed to it and more likely to get addicted to it. And that's what we're seeing, is a kind of a general compulsive overuse of digital media. The Pew Charitable Trust, I think it was, just came out with a statistic saying that 50% of teenagers now report they are continuously online, continuously. So, all of their waking hours are sort of connected to the internet, unable to detach. It's just really different than how life used to be for teenagers or people in general. So, how to treat addiction, including behavioral addictions, including addiction to digital media, we use biopsychosocial interventions. So we have medications. Biological interventions include medications. And believe it or not, people are looking at medications to treat behavioral addiction. So for example, naltrexone is an opioid receptor blocker that's been looked at for gambling addiction. I use it effectively for sex addictions. It might even be good for digital media addictions, although I've never used it in that context. We have things like Ozempic and Wegovy, which are originally prescribed for diabetes, now being looked at for obesity, now being effectively studied and showing good signal for drug addiction and being looked at for things like gambling addiction. So we have medicines. Then in terms of the psychosocial part, we have individual psychotherapy, group psychotherapy, and then the contextual part is changing our environment so we're not constantly exposed to our drug of choice. When it comes to computers and digital media, this, first of all, setting the goal, what does abstinence look like for me, is really important because most people have to be on the internet and on their devices for their work or for school. So the bottom line for people with severe tech addiction or internet addiction is I will not use my device for entertainment or to change the way I feel. Which is, if you just reflect on that, how many times today have you gone on the internet, essentially?
Right, like I'm bored.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. To change the way you feel or to entertain. Most of us do it many hours in the day. But if you start being consciously aware of that and try not to do it, it's a different relationship. So that's one of the ways to think about it. The other is actual technological guardrails, like we're trying to get with kids, you know, where maybe the algorithms don't, you know, give them a chronological feed instead of the feed that optimizes for their time and attention. You know, things like certain websites, kids not having access to pornography websites and having to register their age with a third website in order to access a pornography website. Of course, that comes right into direct conflict with privacy laws, right? Adults who want to go on pornography site do not want to have to register with a third site that they're going on the pornography site. So it's a lot of really challenging issues, which are going to take a lot of collective thinking to try to solve.
Yeah. So this idea of like having a personal AI on your phone, on your device, that's there to protect you, that doesn't work for Apple or anybody else, that works for you. And its objective is, we talked about this in one of our prior conversations, or, you know, that works for you, that's job it is to, as you pointed out, like fulfill on whatever your objective is. And if that is to binge, then unfortunately that could become the new big addiction. But for those who are trying to use it to manage, at least it can prevent or block, you know, this sort of AIs that work for Facebook or TikTok, right? As you said, like, TikTok could reorganize their feed for kids, or we could just reorganize the feed on the device and not rely on TikTok.
Yeah, right.
To do that.
Not just look at software, also hardware. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry, Josh, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think we're accustomed to this world where we're surrounded by algorithms, but they're all kind of manipulating us. Like, I think that is sort of this radical concept that you could have your own set of algorithms sort of protecting you. And then there's this other piece of the puzzle, like with technology, the OneReach platform that Rob created was used to create sort of a chatbot that helped people quit smoking. And it was effective, and it was behavior modification. I think it just kind of used like a nudge system where it slowly manipulated people's behavior and helped them quit smoking, which is a great thing. But if we expand that to think of like this personal assistant that might curate the social media you interact with and try and lessen some of the damage that comes in from these other algorithms, still has that problem of being a connected device. And how do you kind of create that world where you're only allowed to see what's good for you to see? And how do you convince people that that's a better way to interact with technology when they're used to just kind of drinking from the fire hose?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, like for the majority of teenagers today will say that they wish they were online less, and that they feel like they're addicted to their devices. And I think I don't know what the survey results are for adults, but I think we've sort of reached a tipping point where people are like, yeah, I kind of hate my phone. You know, like I It's like, I really would like some more freedom from my phone. So I think we are at the place where people desire a different and better relationship with the technology. The problem is, again, the message is the massage, or the medium is the massage. It's just so, feels so good that it's, and it's so ubiquitous. And also then it's so integrated into work and into school that you almost can't not be on it, right? Kids can't just like say, well, I'm just going to go back to a notebook and a pencil. It's like, no, you got to go on to see if your schedule changed 15 minutes ago. So that's the problem. It can, you know, it can come from individuals, but our individual alone is not going to cut it, right? It's a collective problem, and there have to be both top down and bottom up solutions. And I guess I just feel like I just feel, based on just my own intuition, that part of having a healthy relationship with this technology is going to include some period of our waking hours every day not connected. So it has to be an AI that says, get off. Like, you do not need me right now. You can leave your house without me. I mean, we're really already there, where people feel naked without their devices, like panicky, like, oh, my kid must be in constant, where's my, you know, find my iPhone. I must know where my child. I mean, we didn't grow up with our parents knowing where we were. You know, do you know what I'm saying? Like, it's a collective narrative. And you know, the tech, not what, there was another great quote in your book. I'm trying to remember what it was. It was like, we create the tools and the tools dictate what our behavior. It's like, exactly right.
Oh, yeah,
like,
yeah.
We've made the tools, and now we're living as almost, you know, enslaved by the tools that we've made. So this is, I think, where the different kind of awareness has to come in.
The idea that AI will shape us is an interesting one, because, you know, that's a quote out there, you know, that's used a lot. It's out of Marshall McLuhan again. You know, I think I forget who he got it from. But it was, yeah, we shape our tools and then our tools shape us. But AI, it's like on another level. And I puzzle that out a lot. How is, like, we're still shaping AI. We haven't quite gotten to the point where it's shaping us. And I feel like that's where the conversation should be. How will it shape us, and how do we avoid it shaping us in a way that, like you said, doesn't depress us, right? the idea that we're going to trust these business models that are, like, let's look at Facebook, right? It's advertisers pay the bill. You don't pay the bill, so you're not really the customer. And there's a lot of people who really criticize that model and think that that's a really destructive model, because you're not the consumer of Facebook. The advertiser is the consumer of Facebook. So Facebook is trying, you're like a
you're
pawn.
The tool.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're the product. Yeah.
Yes, you're the product. Exactly. I wonder if just some of these things fundamentally have to change. I don't want to get lost in something totally outside the dopamine world, but there is an interesting way to look at AI, and to say that the beginning of AI really happened at the start of the corporation and the company. And that's actually the first AI, because we give this thing an entity, we give it an objective, we, in the case of a corporation, we even give it its own tax ID and its own tax laws. It has its own liability, and now we're giving it a tool to talk, and it has its own objective, and that objective is to make money. To whatever we give it, which is typically make money, increase the stock. And we look at the danger of that AI, if we want to define that as AI, which I would, and we say, okay, well, is AI going to hurt us? Is AI going to possibly even threaten us as a species? And you're like, too late. What do you think global warming is? And what do you think, where do you think it came from? It came from companies that's objective was to make money, not to
be able to spend it in
longevity
years.
Of the human yeah. race, but longevity yeah, of the yeah. company, right? So you've got these companies that's objective is their own longevity. And now we see that their longevity is in direct competition with ours. And now when these companies, become more anthropomorphic, they become more dangerous. That's one way to look at it. And then the flip side is to say, on the other hand, when you put it in AI in the hands of people, it might be the company itself that's actually most at threat right now than us, because you imagine that if we all get AIs that can call up our insurance company, our healthcare provider, and or argue against the parking ticket and has unlimited time to call. Companies don't have unlimited humans to answer phones. And we see these laws where you can automatically dial a company, but they can't send a robot after you, right? So now all it's going to take is us to start asking our AIs to just, always switch credit cards so we can get the best offer, to, argue every bill that comes in on our, where we don't even have to do anything. And the question is, like, how are companies going to cope with this? So I feel like I'm going down a whole rabbit hole here, but I do think that this concept of objective and what the AI's objective is at the heart of, is the objective to induce dopamine and to be addictive? And is the business model actually, not the AI itself, but the business model at the heart of it, the idea that we're products?
Yeah, love that. So interesting. I mean, one way to think about capitalism is that the ideal capitalism, we would all be addicts, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
And so, the counterforce to that, as you described it, is AI in the hands of the people.
Right.
Which, in my opinion, brings us back to where we started, which is this idea of radical honesty. Because even though I'm a big proponent for guardrails of AI to protect kids, I actually think that the only way we will be able to preserve an AI for the people, of the people, by the people, for the people, would be an AI that is radically honest, that allows.
This is super interesting.
Everybody pretty much to say everything, because otherwise there's just such danger of consolidating power in a small group that gets to control the narrative. And then people don't have access to all of the information. And then once that starts happening, danger zone. So, for all the things I could criticize Elon Musk for, I really think he was right about Twitter and, the town square idea. Like, it only works if you let everybody on. I don't know. Otherwise, it's just a different kind of corporation.
Yeah. This idea of radically honest AI sounds like the right words.
Uh-huh.
Well, it feels like a radically honest AI might actually have the side benefit of being a little bit off-putting in a way that would sort of de-anthropomorphize it.
Yeah.
It's not making you comfortable.
Exactly. And there's like, a proactive, there's like a proactive insinuation that radically, like, it's not enough to just be honest if you ask. It's got to be proactively honest.
Right. And what you get is that crowds, you get sort of self-policing, I think. You get some really wackadoodle, like the worst id expressions, which we already see, like people just acting out their, ego id stuff on the internet. But then you get enough other people to say, like, dude, that's gross. We do not want to be that. And I think that that those then fluctuations. So what you get is real information transmission. Like you, there's a lot of garbage and horrible stuff, but there's also like true information somewhere in there. Mm-hmm. And I think we as humans, that's what we're good at doing, is sorting out the information to find patterns, to find like the real, real.
Yeah, I guess like Wikipedia sort of works in that way a little bit.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
Anyone can post information there, and then there's a committee of people that work to kind of decide what's valid,
right,
and
right,
what doesn't belong there.
Right. And I think, unfortunately, universities don't work in many instances that way anymore. You know, universities used to be the place of free speech and, you know, controversial opinions and informed debate. And like, that's not what's happening anymore. There's certain narratives that are allowed and certain narratives that aren't. And like, you can't say that the emperor has no clothes. You really can't, unless you're willing to be canceled or lose your job. So that's not good.
Yeah. Is radical honesty, is it fair enough to say it's the kind of honesty that hurts when you do it?
That's right. That's a great sort of shorthand for it. Like, if it doesn't feel good when you have to say X, Y, or Z, you're on the right track.
Yeah. If you like naturally feel defensive as soon as you hear
it, yes. Yes.
Then it's probably pointing to a truth.
Yes. Yeah. So funny. I was just working today with a family, the parents and their child, their adult child, who's terribly addicted to video games, dropped out of college, not thriving. Nice kid, smart. But anyway, you know, they had some radical honesty in the session just in terms of mom being triggered and losing it and raising her voice. And then her saying, but I don't raise my voice. I'm very calm. Everybody says I'm a quiet person. And then her husband and her son are like, no, you're screaming. It was just one of those moments like, yeah, I think you're going to have to take that information in.
Yeah, I'm going to have to think on this one. Radically honest AI. I love it.
Good. Great.
Maybe that's
the future.
Feels right.
Okay, good. Yes. You got to go with your feelings.
Yeah. I was thinking, you know, I think I was centering a lot on the anthropomorphic component of it, but I think it's broader than that. It's deception, yeah. Not just
right.
of being human, but deception, period. I think that's what we're yeah. afraid of, right? Deceptive AI. That's...
Yeah. And I think so much of what people are looking for, really, you know, want to find on the internet is the truth, right? Like they do. People go on the internet looking for answers, you know, answers to their own lives, answers to humanity's problems. I mean, people want to know, you know, the real deal.
Yeah. So I think on this note, this is a good way to kind of wrap it up. But I wanted to talk and get your perspective on one of the nice things about machines is we don't, and I think you can add more color to this, but we don't ascribe sort of intent or judgment. So when it is radically honest with us, we take it better, right? We don't, it's less loaded. And we've seen this in a lot of our work where, whether it was teaching kids to read, the smoking cessation that Josh mentions, we work with a nonprofit that uses it to try to curb underage sex trafficking. And its main job is to communicate with the buyers and kind of just let them know like the implications of their behavior. To the world, so it's not necessarily just there to catch them and be punitive. It's there, and just it's really interesting how different people receive that when it's a machine versus human. How much less defensive they are. Even just time tracking and getting people to like nudging them when they forgot to put in their time. They're just, you know, they take it better from a machine. I just wonder if you had thoughts on that.
Yeah. I mean, I think that when people have the sense that the response they're getting is from the wisdom of the collective, that's a welcome input, right? This idea that, wow, this is coming from the amalgamation of all of this lived human experience saying to me, I really should do X or I shouldn't do Y. I think there's a very interesting way in which people are going to orient on AI in a religious or spiritual way, where they will look to, for better and for worse, right? Which is why, like, the radically honest AI is going to be so important. They're going to look to AI for the collective wisdom. I already see this, you know, again, it's anecdotal, but, you know, my teenagers who will go on to AI and say, well, how, we have a friend who we don't want to invite to come out with us to this party. How can we tell her no in a nice way? They got a whole list of options from AI and they followed them and it worked well, right? And this idea of like, people aren't just, they're going for the emotional stuff. And when they get a good result like that, yeah, it's easier to get that than, especially for a teenager, than like from your mom who really doesn't know. Better to get it from, the collective wisdom of a radically honest AI than from dad.
Yeah, I like this. I like this. This is a good answer. I think this, there's hope for AI to like be radically honest buddy that you don't take personally.
Yeah, and hopefully not Big Brother, right? That's
yes,
the other.
Definitely not Big Brother.
Ideally not. Well, right. That's interesting too, because before we got on this call, Rob and I were kind of wondering about the role AI could play in sort of providing therapeutic services to people, especially as they're struggling with addiction. I guess it's conventional wisdom would seem to think that like human to human therapy is probably going to be the best, but maybe there is this approach, this sort of radically honest AI approach, where there are certain things that you could be told by an AI in a therapy setting that you'd hear more clearly in a way, or that you'd respond to in a way that would, move your therapy along quicker, hasten the healing a little bit. I don't know if that's possible or if that seems unreasonable, but.
No, I think it's all possible and we're going to have, it's already being looked at and we should explore that. But I just think it must always also not lead to that AI being then the relationship.
Right.
It's like you can go there for wisdom and guidance and insight and truth talking that maybe, you couldn't get from someone in your family or don't want to go see a therapist or whatever it is. But then it needs to move on from there. It can't be then me with my blow up doll and my AI chatbot living in a cubicle. You know what I mean? I mean, because that's also happening. And I guess, Rob, I have to really disagree with you. But earlier you said that you don't think AI is shaping us yet. And I disagree. I think we're already so the loneliness epidemic, the sheer number of people who live alone, in part because it's now possible to connect, through the internet. I mean, our lives are just unbelievably shaped by this techno. I actually even think our COVID response was more about the technology at our disposal than about the actual virus and the implications of the virus. The kids would have gone back to school much, much earlier if there was no option for online school.
Yeah, I think
so
you're
things
right.
Like
I think
that.
I'd correct myself and say that the conversational AI component, not just AI, because you're right, our technology is shaping us. It's this new talking to our machines and them talking to us that we're at the beginning of. And that's the one I think is going to be super impactful,
Yeah.
Haven't been talked to by our machines. It's still interfaces, it's still text. It's still obviously not human.
I guess we're better suited to maybe see some of that gradation, having had to go to like a computer department to check email once upon a time, as opposed to just always talking to machines. So
we remember the static buzz of a modem. Remember that?
Yeah,
chills. Yes.
Yeah, I had a funny story where someone used their email client to type a letter, then printed it, then drove over to my mailbox and put it in my mail.
books. Love it. That's great. It's my kind of Luddite.
All right, guys. Well, this was great. Great.
Yeah. Thanks. Great conversation.
So much,
yeah, you're welcome.
All right. Well, thanks for hanging out with us again here on Invisible Machines. Don't forget to like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Always remember that you can watch this podcast, too, on our Invisible Machines YouTube channel. Head over to uxmag.com. We have a podcast page there where you can explore our back catalog, and you can look at episodes centered around popular topics. Many, many thanks to our incredible production team here in the U.S. and in Ukraine, Elias Parker, Michael Litvinov, Allison Harshberger, Alla Slesarenko, Vera Pokodkov, and Darina Moskovchuk. Till next week. Owagi.